Jeanette Winterson is the author of almost a dozen novels, a book of nonfiction, a comic book, several books for children, and two screenplays. She's won a number of prestigious awards, and now, more than 25 years after her first novel, Oranges Are Not the Only Fruit, was published, she's written a memoir. It's called Why Be Happy When You Can Be Normal? Something her adoptive mother asked her after learning that her daughter was a lesbian. Her adoptive mother, whom she calls Mrs. Winterson in her new book, is a formidable woman, a religious fanatic whose cruelty is breathtaking. Jeanette Winterson escaped through fiction and poetry, which she writes was her medicine. She joins us on Radio Time to talk about growing up in Northern England in the 1960s and 70s and what it was like to write about her life. And Jeanette Winterson joining us from the CSPS Monitor Broadcasting Studios in Boston. And congratulations on your book, and nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
Did it take a certain kind of courage and even clarity to write this memoir?
Sometimes a book overtakes you with its own force, and that's what happened with Why Be Happy When You Could Be Normal. It began because I was searching for my biological mother, Bioma, as I call her, because after my father died at the end of 2008, I found some paperwork which I'd never seen before, and which Mrs. Winterson, in her usual Secret Service fashion, had hidden away. And it led me to believe that my mother might still be alive. Mrs. Winston had always said my biological mother was dead, but she'd adopted so many mothers for me in her mind. You know, there were bad mothers and mad mothers and exploding mothers and drunk mothers and drugged mothers. So to find one that might actually be out there, I set off on the search and began documenting it. And that, naturally enough, made me think again about Winterson World.
A Winterson World, which is the world of your mother's making in many ways. When she said to you, why be happy when you could be normal? And there's a question mark, obviously, at the end. How did she say that to you? What did she sound like?
Well, she was a violent philosopher. But she always had the best lines, you know, like a Shakespearean villain. And it was when I was leaving home because I'd fallen in love with another girl in a very ordinary and straightforward way. I don't think sexuality is rigidly defined, and I think we mistake when we imagine it is, especially in young people. But for Mrs. Winston, who's a fundamentalist, it wasn't just no sex, it was no sex with your own sex, so I was in big trouble. Mm-hmm. And she said, look, either you leave home or you give up the girl. Well, what would your listeners do? So I was packing my bag, and as I was leaving, she called me back and she said, just tell me why you're doing this. And I said, I can't tell you much, Mum, but it makes me happy. And then she said, why be happy when you could be normal?
And this is a woman. And interestingly, as I mentioned in the intro and you just said there, your adoptive mother, whom you call Mrs. Winterson.
Yes.
Does that give you a little distance on her to make her Mrs. Winterson as opposed to mother or mom or mummy?
Well, those emotional words, mother and ma, mummy, you know, they have certain qualities that we associate with them without really thinking. And I don't think those qualities could really apply to Mrs. Winterson. She was a larger than life figure. You know, she was the big screen character in the small screen of our lives. She was a flamboyant depressive. You know, this was a woman who kept a revolver in the duster drawer.
Well, in fact, I'd love to have you read, speaking of a revolver in the dusted drawer, I'd actually love to have you read from the very beginning, the very first page of your memoir.
Okay, this is chapter one, and it's called The Wrong Crib. When my mother was angry with me, which was often, she said, "The devil led us to the wrong crib." The image of Satan taking time off from the Cold War and McCarthyism to visit Manchester, 1960, purpose of visit to deceive Mrs. Winterson, has a flamboyant theatricality to it. She was a flamboyant depressive, a woman who kept a revolver in the duster drawer and the bullets in a tin of pledge, a woman who stayed up all night baking cakes to avoid sleeping in the same bed as my father, a woman with a prolapse, a thyroid condition, an enlarged heart, an ulcerated leg that never healed, and two sets of false teeth, matte for every day, and a pearlized set for best. I don't know why she couldn't have children. I know that she adopted me because she wanted a friend, she had none, and because I was like a flare sent out into the world, a way of saying that she was here, a kind of X marks the spot. She hated being a nobody, and like all children, adopted or not, I have had to live out some of her unlived life. We do that for our parents. We don't really have any choice.
I love that. It's the very beginning of Jeanette Winterson's memoir called Why Be Happy When You Could Be Normal? She's a scary mother. I mean, she was not my mother, obviously, and I'm reading what you write in this book, but she terrified me.
She was pretty scary. I mean, I talk about her later as a monster, and I say she was a monster, but she was my monster. And, you know, the battle between us was really the battle between happiness and unhappiness. Now, Mrs. Winterson, deeply religious, hated life. She thought of life as a pre-death experience, which is difficult when you're a child yourself and you're full of life. And that was our battle, our struggle. And for her, everything was grey and gloomy. And when I used to say to her, well, if God created the world, why did he create such a terrible small town as Accrington where we live? And she said, it doesn't matter, because when the apocalypse comes, it'll all be blown up.
And she was a Pentecostal?
Yeah, she was a Pentecostal. We had a gospel tent. We used to go around to the seaside towns trying to save souls. And we lived in end time. You know, she was an eschatologist. She was waiting for the last days. And, you know, this was a woman who read the Bible to us rather marvellously and dramatically, my father and I, every day. She used to stand up and read it out loud. And she'd start at Genesis and work all the way through to Revelation, which was her favourite bit. And when she got to the bit where the devil is bound and thrown into the bottomless pit and everything is rolled up like a scroll, then she'd stop and give us 2 weeks to think about it, then go right back to the beginning and start again.
I mean, she was also, as you describe, an amazing, or sounds like an interesting, compelling storyteller as well, even talking about her own life.
Yeah, she understood language, although books were forbidden in our house because she thought that sedition and controversy were fired by printed matter. She was nevertheless a pamphleteer by temperament, so the entire house was stuck up with texts and exhortations, all of which she'd written out herself. You know, over the oven there was a sign that said, "Man shall not live by bread alone." Under my coat peg it said, "Think of God, not the dog."
Well, you were allowed to have several books, you meaning the family, allowed to have only several very prescribed books in the house. And she says, the trouble with a book, you never know what's in it until it's too late. And it seems to me, talk about forbidden fruit, right?
She's right, though. I mean, yes. she was always spot on with her understandings. And you never know what's in a book. You fall into it and then the story takes you somewhere else. And that's, of course, is what happened to me. You know, books and doors are the same. You open them, you go through into another world.
Well, and you kept books hidden under your, what, mattress?
Yeah, because they weren't allowed in. I used to have jobs working the markets, and I was always good at earning my own money because I needed it. And I used to smuggle books in, I hid them under the mattress. And your listeners will all know that if you've got a single bed, standard size, and a collection of paperbacks, standard size, you can fit 72 per layer under the mattress. You can try this at home, it's safe. But, of course, even if Mrs. Winterson hadn't been a paid-up member of her own private secret service, she would have noticed that her daughter's bed was rising visibly. I was like the princess and the pea, you know, I was closer to the ceiling than the floor. So one day she came in and she saw a corner of a book sticking out from under the mattress, and it was a terrible moment because it was D.H. Lawrence, Women in Love. And she knew that Lawrence was a Satanist and a pornographer, so she pulled it out. All the books came out, me as well, tumbling off the bed, the dog barking, my dad rushing in his pyjamas. She took all the books, threw them out of the window into the little backyard, and then she took the kerosene stove that we used because we had no heating, and she poured the kerosene over the books and set them on fire.
Quite a vivid memory there. You also say, you talk about books and doors, because one of the things you also write in this memoir is that you like doors, maybe even to this day, you like an open door. You like doors to be open. What is an escape hatch?
I don't know. It's interesting. I like liminal space. You know, it's why I like cats, because they're always on the threshold. And, you know, you can only keep them at home as long as they can go out. And I guess that's kind of like me. Because Mrs. Winterson was in charge of the key in the door, and because she used to lock me out a lot on the doorstep when she wasn't locking me in the coal hole, it seems very important to me that I should be now the one who's in control of the door. And I need to know that it's always open. A, because I like to welcome people, but B, because I may need to escape. You know, this is a woman, when somebody knocked at our front door, she'd run down the hallway with the poker and shove it through the letterbox.
To keep them away?
Well, it would frighten you off, wouldn't it?
It would indeed.
Where the average letterbox is placed in the door. It was a pretty terrible sight to see this poker suddenly. And the only time that she ever did answer the door was when the Mormons came round, because she'd then wait behind and then open it and wave her Bible at them and warn them about eternal damnation. And this was really confusing for the Mormons, because they thought they were in charge of eternal damnation. But she was a better candidate for the job.
Well, as I said, a formidable woman, Mrs. Winterson, your mother. You mentioned almost in passing that she would lock you out of the house, which she did. In fact, you describe sitting all night on your doorstep, actually drinking the milk that was delivered to the doorstep. You talk about, write about being locked in the coal bin, as you describe it, I guess, or the coal hole. For what? What were your infractions that you were being punished for?
Oh, endless. And she always managed to separate the crime and the punishment. So I never really took it seriously, because certainly as a child, you really need to make connections. And if you're punished much later for something, you don't make connections. Mm. You just become rebellious. But there was always a reason for locking me outside. I think she thought it was good for children and that it would somehow reform my character. In fact, what it did do was make me disappear into my head, because I just told myself stories. That's the place that I lived. Because, you know, either you're going to give in and be beaten by something like that, or you're going to find some private escape. And for me, it was storytelling.
And I do want to get to all of that, but just you also describe that this is sitting on the doorstep. In the morning, your father would let you into the house, but he wouldn't say a word.
No, he never fought for me. It's a shame, because I liked my dad, but he was weak and Mrs. Winterson was formidable. So he didn't stand up for me. And so she'd act like it was normal to leave your kid locked out all night, and he'd act like it was normal, you know, and then that it was normal never to sleep with your husband, and normal to keep a revolver in the duster drawer, and normal to have two sets of false teeth. So we lived in a very strange world. Winterson world was not normal, but it was described as such by Mrs. W.
Mrs. W, and he beat you, your father, but instructed by your mother, Mrs. Winterson.
Yes, that was the separation of crime and punishment. If a beating was deserved, she would simply wait till he came off shift work. He worked shift. He worked very hard. You know, we were working class, we were poor. Yeah. And then she'd say how many lashes, whether it was the hand or the belt or the cane. You know, she was in charge of everything.
We're almost
poor
up
dad.
In a, poor dad. Well, poor you, don't you think?
Yeah, I do. But, you know, some people say to me, oh, it's so sad you had this abused childhood. And I get really angry with them. And I say, I was not abused. It's strange the things that you accommodate to yourself. And in any case, I'm free.
Well, you are. And I want to pick up on all of that after this very short break. And our guest today in Radio Times is British writer Jeanette Winterson. She's written many, many books. And now, after more than 25 years after her first novel was published, she's written a memoir. It's called Why Be Happy When You Could Be Normal. We're going to take a very short break and then get back to our conversation, talking more about what it was like to grow up in Northern England in the 60s and 70s, what life was like inside of Mrs. Winterson. House. We're going to take a very short break. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY Bosch Thermotechnology, manufacturer of geothermal heat pumps that use the constant temperature of the earth to heat and cool homes. More information at boschgeo.com.
This is Ira Glass of This American Life, and I'm excited to announce that I'm coming to Princeton, New Jersey to give a talk about how we put together a radio show each week. I'll be playing clips and favorite stories, and I can basically mix the show on stage live as you watch. And unlike some other public radio hosts, I do not sing. It'll be Sunday, April 29th, 3 in the afternoon at the MacArthur Theater in Princeton. Proceeds benefit WHYY. For more information, visit whyy.org/member experience.
Spring is just about here, and you might be making plans to clean out the closets, the garage, or the basement. How about using this season to tidy up your finances? An expert organizer offers tips for spring cleaning your financial life, which she says might tidy up other parts of your life. That's next time on Tell Me More.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
C. Seventh Generation supports WHYY, makers of plant-based 4X laundry detergent, a cold water clean in a cardboard bottle. To learn where to find their product, seventhgeneration.com/store locator. Seventh Generation, caring today for seven generations of tomorrows.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with Jeanette Winterson about her memoir called Why Be Happy When You Could Be Normal. She's a British writer, had a tough childhood growing up in an industrial town in northern England in the 60s and 70s, raised by adoptive parents. They were poor. As I said, times were tough. We're also taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Jeanette, why do you think your parents adopted you?
Mrs. Winterson couldn't have children. We don't know why. I think it's probably because she never had sex with my father, and one thing tends to follow the other. Mm-hmm. And in any case, she believed that God would lead her to a baby, so maybe you don't need to go through the normal methods if you really believe that. And she believed that she would get a child who would be a missionary and would go out and save souls. In a way, she did get what she wanted.
Interesting. But do you feel like you were living in a loveless house?
No, I didn't. Now, whether that's because that was too much for me to bear, so I couldn't think of it like that. I think she did love me in her own way, but it was a dark love, and it wasn't an easy love. She didn't know how to love. You know, she hadn't been well parented herself, and her father was a seductive thug who'd married her mother, and the mother had given him the money, and he'd womanized it away. She hated all of that. And so I think she found there was a certain coarseness around love. She didn't think love was at all reliable, and so she couldn't offer a reliable kind of love either.
You write here, the working class north of England was a routinely brutal world, and this is the 60s and 70s when you were growing up. Can you expand on that?
Yeah, I think it was a working class culture, and it was rougher, and people thought about things differently in those days. You know, men did hit their wives, and wives would also hit their husbands, which was accepted if it was for gambling away the housekeeping money or womanising. You know, a woman would give as good as she got, and nobody really questioned that. And of course, kids were just hit routinely. It wasn't a good thing, but it was what happened in the culture. So it wasn't that people were being particularly bad; they were just doing what everybody else did at the time.
You describe the kind of, I guess, world you could create in your imagination, also the world you discovered through reading. Help us understand why, and perhaps even how, that turned you into a writer yourself.
Because language became for me a luminous place. It became a place where I could both construct an identity, and all adopted children are self-invented. You know, we have to be, because the first part of our story is missing. It's, you know, it is like reading a book with the first few pages gone, or arriving after curtain up. So you need to start constructing a story. And also, Mrs. Winterson's stories were so powerful and also so dark that I needed to have something to set against them. So right from the beginning, I was setting my story against hers. You know, that's how we fought. We fought over the territory of language. Because books were forbidden in the house, and the smuggled in ones were a problem, I decided that I would go down to the library, which was a fabulous library built with Carnegie money in 1907, in the days when, yeah, working class men in particular didn't think that there was anything to be ashamed of in wanting to better yourself. You know, it wasn't assumed that all culture was relative, and you were meant to go out to workers' extension lectures, to evening classes, and learn more than you knew. You know, that was seen as a good thing. So I went down to this library, and there was English literature in prose, A to Z, huge. And I thought, okay, I'll start at A. Unfortunately, her name's Austin, and then you get the Brontes and Dickens and Eliot. You do really well at the beginning, so it kind of cheers you up and bounces you along. So that's what I did, and it seemed to me that the great writers weren't remote. You know, they were with me in Accrington, in this small town. It never occurred to me that this was something I couldn't have. You know, this was a place where I could go, and one of the things that worries me, you know, now about the way that libraries have just been shredded, and it's just all computer terminals, is what would a kid like me do? Because you can't Google this stuff. I know, you can't Kindle it. Either it's there in front of you, and your inquiring mind will roam round, or you're not going to find it.
You wrote something, and I wrote it down because it just struck me, which is that you needed words because unhappy families are conspiracies of silence. That the power, I guess, of what is unsaid in an unhappy family.
Yes. I mean, and we're always with language trying to say as much as we can and hope that the silences will be heard. I mean, I think of words as the part of silence that can be spoken.
Mm.
So much around that story cannot be spoken, ever. But what we do write, what we do say, is a way of appeasing or soothing what exists, because stories are compensatory. You know, they give us meaning and sense and pattern to our lives, because we're meaning-seeking creatures. And if you live in a random, chaotic, out-of-control world, what do? You seek to find a meaning, to make sense of things.
And as you say, words as medicine.
Yes.
Healing.
I think of words as healing. You know, sometimes people talk about reading as a luxury. They think it's something that you do in your leisure time. And I think, well, you know, these people must have had it pretty easy, because it seems to me that we need something to protect our inner life, our imagination, the vulnerable places, the poignant places, the difficult places. Art and literature are very good at doing that. And so I think if we say that reading's a luxury, we're really saying that being human is a luxury.
You left home around the age of 16. Where did you go? That's pretty young.
Yeah, well, that was the choice, you know, leave the girl or leave home. So off I went. And I started off living in the back of a Mini. And that was a small Mini, not the kind of funky ones you've got now. But the
How
little
does one do
of,
that, live in the back of a Mini?
Beatles 1960s style Mini. You have to have an order and a discipline. And this would work for anybody. You may find they have to live in a car. Above all, you don't make a mess. You keep yourself with kind of army discipline. So what I used to do was read in the front over the steering wheel, so I could rest the book on the wheel. And then I'd eat in the passenger seat. But in order to do either of these activities, I'd open the door and go around to the other door, because that made me feel, you know, like I had a choice. It was like going into a different room. And I used to sleep in the back. Fortunately, I'm not very tall. But in the winter, of course, the condensation would form on the top of the tin roof of the car, and I'd be like a leaf covered in little drops of water in the morning. And then later, fortunately, a teacher from my school realised that something was going wrong, and she let me stay with her, and that was how I was able to take my exams and get myself to Oxford University.
Part of this story is also your search for your birth mother. And as you did, as you told us in that reading, that your adoptive mother, Mrs. Winterson, spoke of you as the devil led us to the wrong crib. The idea that they had actually adopted the wrong child, and it was the devil's fault.
Very fairy tale, that, wasn't it?
I mean, indeed.
You know, that's how she set things up, you know, with these larger-than-life archetypes, which actually, looking back on it, I think was pretty good, because I think children can cope with anything except emptiness of mind. And whatever else there was, my mind was stuffed full of symbols, of images, of ideas, and, of course, of language. And that was enough of a toolkit to deal with everything else.
But were you looking to the answer about whether you were wanted or not?
Well, I knew I wasn't, certainly not by them, and I thought that love was something I would have to go out and seek. So, you know, immediately I began to delineate my own life as a quest story. You know, it would be a search, and I would have to get to the boundaries of common sense and cross over if I wanted to find something that could be real to me. So I set off. You know, I've always had great hope, great optimism. I mean, that seems to have been a temperamental gift, maybe from the good fairy, before I got to the bad mother.
Well, and it sounds like you were a difficult child in your own way. And
oh, I was. I was too spiky and too intense and too odd. And, you know, school never worked, because they can always spot the oddball at school, can't they? Although embroidering "The Summer Is Ended and We Are Not Yet Saved" on my gym bag made me easy to spot.
And were you kind of a, maybe even to this day, a loner who wanted to belong?
I think everybody wants to belong. You know, we are tribal creatures. We like to have a society. We know we need to draw apart to think our own thoughts and be our own person. But I think everybody would like to feel validated and understood by their community. It's very difficult, you know, always to be up on there on the rocks, living the outside life, you know. So, yes, there was that. And the church at first provided both comfort and solace, and it was a real community, so separate to Winterson World. And I loved that. And I think, you know, there's still a lot to be said for those church communities. You know, they do give people a sense of belonging, and that's really important.
Do you go to church now?
No, I don't. I don't think organized religion has a lot to offer the way I see it at present, which isn't to put aside any spiritual understanding. I think, and I don't even know whether there's a God. Who does? But if there is a God, he or she must be religion-proof.
Well, that's Jeanette Winterson, our guest today on Radio Times. More than 25 years ago, she wrote a novel called Oranges Are Not the Only Fruit, and now she's written a memoir, Why Be Happy When You Could Be Normal. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. I don't want to give too much of the story away, but nonetheless, the story is pretty compelling. You write about discovering a birth certificate, your birth certificate, that was in a closet.
Yes, I always thought that I had discovered my birth certificate when I was small. You know how children find things when they're always poking around and fiddling in drawers and
yes.
things. And I thought I had found it and that it had the names of my parents on it. And I kept that completely secret right through my adult life. I didn't tell lovers or friends or anything. I don't know why I didn't, but it just felt like something I couldn't speak of. And then later, when I decided it was time to try and open my adoption file, which was a difficult and complicated thing to do, I discovered that that original certificate wasn't mine at all. It appears to have been this ghostly other brother, the one who presumably would have been the right crib in the orphanage that the Wintersons failed to take, you know, when they were misled by Satan.
Well, and when you found your real birth certificate, what did it say?
It was strange because, you know, even now, if you see anything that's typewritten, it looks like it was done before the flood. It's kind of antediluvian, even though it's within many people's lifetimes. And things handwritten and crossed out. So there was this certificate, which was a kind of health check for babies, saying that I was fit to be adopted, that I wasn't a mental defective. And alarmingly, that I didn't have any coloured blood in me. Mm. I mean, they were still freaking out about that, you know, in the 60s. So it was this whole thing saying what I was and that I was, you know, good to go. And then there was my adoption order, which was dated from the court. And again, that was handwritten. But I had another name, and it had been violently crossed out. And the paper had been ripped so that I couldn't see the name of the adoption society. So I thought, Mrs. Winterson's had a real go at these documents because she doesn't want me to know anything. Naturally enough, that set me on the search.
And a search that led you to your birth mother.
Astonishingly, yes, yeah. Because I don't know what it is in the States, but in the UK until 1978, all adoptions were made on the basis of closed records. So there was never meant to be any contact between the parent and the child. And then to do so later became rather torturous. So it was a bit of a labyrinth. But yes, she was alive and I found her. And far from being a solitary orphan, which I'd always cast myself in my mind as being, I discover that my mother was one of 10 children, that I had countless numbers of uncles and aunts, and that they were all ballroom dancing champions.
What a wonderful discovery. Were you nervous about meeting your birth mother?
Terrified. Mm. And you don't know how it will hit you emotionally. You think that you can sort it out. You know, and there was I was a successful woman. I knew how to work the world. I had money in the bank. I had houses. You know, a really confident person. And suddenly, I'm back to being a tiny child again, and I don't know how to cope with this. And I'm bewildered and I'm frightened, and I'm getting out of the cab. And I just have a hysterical impulse to sing Cheer Up, Ye Saints of God, which is what Mrs. Winterson used to sing. And I'm thinking, no, that's the wrong mother. It's the wrong childhood. This is another place now. Do not sing Cheer Up, Ye Saints of God. And then I knock at the door, and there's a lot of barking from inside the house and from a tangle of washing and sub-zero freezing temperatures. Suddenly there's my mother, and her very first line to me after 50 years is, I thought I'd get the washing done before you came.
Which would have also been a very good title for a book, don't you think?
Yeah. And so once, you know, that made things a lot easier. Yeah. And we both laughed and smiled. And then I was able to talk to her very easily for the next 5 hours.
But I would think as an adoptive child, especially in a difficult family, that you would have had this very strong fantasy mother or a fantasy mother that you had created as a kid growing up.
Well, I didn't. And whether that was because I was so cut off, I'm not sure. But I just thought, you know, that having one set of parents had turned out to be a misfortune and that two sets would be a disaster. So I didn't dream about having these other parents, you know, and I didn't pretend that I was either descended from aliens or millionaires. You know, I was just me trying to live my life and work. I always felt independent and solitary. That's how I shaped myself. But, you know, the concomitant to that is that I went out there looking for love. And then you get into the fatal mess of romance, which is you and me against the world, you know. That's the basis of romantic love, which is not really a good basis for going forward.
Well, I want to pick up on that, but let me get some callers in. Looks like we have Rob from Chester joining us on Radio Times. And Rob, go ahead. You're on the air.
Oh, good morning.
Good morning.
Jeanette Winterson, what a miraculous resilience and a brilliant self-construction. My thought, you described your sadness for your father at your beatings, and I'm just wondering, you kept the name. Did you ever think about changing your last name, or do you, even with everything you've described, is there some feeling of love for your mother?
It's a good question, Rob. Yes, go ahead, Jeanette.
Yes, both. I mean, no, I like being called Jeanette Winterson, and it's the name that I made for myself, and it's the name on all of my books. That feels fine to me. It's a good name, and I'm happy with it. But I wouldn't want to change it. But yes, I've completely forgiven Mrs. Winterson. Well, you know, you can only forgive somebody when you can understand them, because understanding allows for compassion. And also, when you're a kid, you know, your parents are always in your way, even if you like them, even if it's a good family. You know, they're just always trouble for you, and you want to go. And you never think of them as people with problems, difficulties, challenges, struggles, heartaches of their own. Later, you begin to understand them as human beings. For me, you know, looking back on Mrs. Winterson, and certainly through writing this book, I now see her own life. You know, I talk about her somewhere as somebody who's just too big for her life and crouched under it, gloomy and constrained. What did she have? You know, those women who were young women in the war, then grew up in the 50s, had to come out, go back in the home, no job opportunities. And it was terrible for them, especially if they were bright. And I didn't understand that till much later.
Well, as you say, you know, helping understand can humanize a person. Rob asked about the word love. Do you feel, Jeanette, do you feel comfortable with that word? Do you know what that word means to you?
Oh, certainly. I always did think of love as the highest value, and I still do. And when I was growing up, there was no difficulty loving nature. You know, I thought God loved me and I love God at that point. That was good. Animals. But it was people that were the problem. I mean, your listeners will recognize this. I mean, how do you love another person? How do you trust another person to love you? And it's taken me really most of my life to learn how to give and receive love in a sane, steady and sensible way, which doesn't diminish love but rather expands it. And that has been part of the quest of my life. You know, I'm still on it, but it's really worthwhile.
I should add that your book is dedicated to, you write here, my three mothers, Constance Witterson, Ruth Rendell, and Anne S.
Yeah, Anne S. is bio-ma.
Is your bio-ma.
Yeah, and Ruth Rendell, the crime writer, of course, is somebody who I met when I was 26, and she was like a really good mother figure because she never judged me. She gave me space to write, looked after me, loved me. You know, I've been very fortunate because people have come into my life to love me and to care for me and just, you know, pick me up from time to time. In that sense, I don't feel like an outcast at all. But you know what? In 1992, I wrote a book called Written on the Body, and the first line is, why is the measure of love loss? Because that's what I understood of love. And it's taken me 20 years to realise I don't believe the first line in my own book anymore, because I don't think that love is loss. And I realise that, you know, when you're a kid, the kind of love that you get is the love that sets. And if love's unreliable, you think that unreliability is intrinsic to love, is its quality. But that's not so. There is the daily rising of love.
We're going to take another short break and get back to our conversation with Jeanette Winterson. And we are talking about family and love and her new book. It's a memoir called Why Be Happy When You Could Be Normal. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Walnut Street Theater brings you the Philadelphia premiere of the Tony Award-winning best play, God of Carnage, a comedy of manners without the manners. Two children get into a fight and one gets hurt. The boy's parents meet to discuss the matter in a civilized manner. However, as the evening goes on, the parents become increasingly childish, resulting in unmannered chaos. The internationally acclaimed comedy God of Carnage, now through April 29th. Details at walnutstreettheater.org, Ticketmaster, or 215-574-3550.
On the next Fresh Air, Pakistani journalist Ahmed Rashid, who wrote the bestseller Taliban before 9/11, talks with us about his new book, Pakistan on the Brink, The Future of America, Pakistan, and Afghanistan. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. Republicans watch closely as voters in Illinois go to their primary. Also, Devil Strip, Terrace, Tree Belt, depending on where you live, those words describe the sort of dirt and grass between a sidewalk and the street. We'll look at the American Dictionary of Regional English. That's Public Radio's daily digest of news and culture here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen, talking with Jeanette Winterson. She wrote her first novel, her first book, which was a novel, semi-autobiographical novel called Oranges Are Not the Only Fruit. Wrote that more than 25 years ago. She was in her mid-20s at the time. The book was a hit. She went on to publish more novels, short stories, children's books, screenplays, even a comic book. Now an established and highly regarded author, she's written a raw and absorbing memoir titled Why Be Happy When You Could Be Normal. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Let me get Angie from Haddon Township to join us on Radio Times. And Angie, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hello. Thanks, Marty.
You're welcome.
Jeanette Winterson, it is such a pleasure to hear you today. I'm actually reading your memoir right now. I've been reading your books for 18 years. And my favorite book is Written on the Body. And I just love how the narrator is genderless, and I assume that was intentional, but did you write that narrator, you know, without a specific gender to show the universality of love and kind of counter your mother's idea of homosexuality and sin?
Thank you.
I can take it off the air.
Okay, fair enough. And thanks for the call to Radio Times. And Jeanette Winterson, go ahead.
Yes, I wanted to see how we would read if we couldn't use our normal assumptions about gender, whether the character was male or female. And I wondered what would happen to the reading process, if it would make the reader uncomfortable, if it would somehow wrong-foot them, but in a good way, so that they would have to think again about their assumptions. Because I think that's one of the purposes of literature. You know, it's meant to make you think outside of the box, to think wider than you normally would, or in a different way, or to surprise yourself. So by removing any trace of gender for the narrator, it really makes us ask, well, what's love about? You know, what's desire about? What's commitment about? And does it make a difference whether this is a male or a female? Of course, it's easy in English because it's not a gendered language. When we've translated it, I mean, some of the notes that I've given, say when it's gone into French, I've just said, just keep mixing it so that it's all one, at one moment it's a male and the other it's a female, so that you never really know, though it is trickier to do it like that.
It's so interesting because that's the first thing when someone has a baby, you know, is it a boy or is it a girl?
That's exactly the first question. And you think, why? What difference does it make? Because I think of gender as a toolkit rather than the final destination. You know, it should be something that we can work with joyfully rather than something that we feel constricts us, you know, whether we're men or whether we're women. I mean, women seem to have had a rougher time of it. You know, feminism has fixed some of that, but not all of it. You know, but men too, just they're often in a carapace of masculinity, a place where they don't want to be. You know, they would like to be able to break out of that, but they can't because society does reinforce the norms all the time. So does the education system. You know, even now when we think we're much more tolerant, and families do too. You know, they freak out if their kids just don't look quite right or act quite right according to their assigned gender.
Well, we even ask that when we meet someone's dog. Is it a boy or is it a girl? Talk about hardwired, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know if it is hardwired, though. You know, yeah. I think so much of it is conditioning in the early years. Of course there are sex differences, you know, and we need to be able to celebrate those and enjoy those. But we also need to allow the widest possible latitude for the human spirit. You know, why do we make prisons for ourselves when we could be free?
Well, and I think rightly or wrongly, it's how we orient ourselves. I mean, it's that sort of knee-jerk question, and depending on what the answer is, then we make a kind of mental orientation or reorientation to that person, or even to that particular dog.
That's true. And, you know, I've never been a believer, for instance, in the gay gene. You know, I sometimes clash with gay people on this, largely because I do think sexuality itself is a spectrum. And I would love there to be a world where people could simply move back and forth along that spectrum without asking themselves, oh, am I gay, am I straight, and slapping a label on themselves and everybody else. It's bonkers. You know, we love where we love, and if you're lucky enough to find love, then I don't think you should question the wrapper.
Have you found love?
Yes. I've always been lucky because I've always had relationships that have taught me something with people that I could respect. And that's really important. You know, respect is crucial. But yes, I mean, lately in the last 3 years, I found somebody who's fantastic, who's sane and grown up. And, you know, that makes all the difference.
Speaking about the book that you wrote and that our caller asked about, Written on the Body, makes me think of your mother and her body, which you write about in your memoir, that she hated her body.
Yes, she did. She was a really large woman. She was 20 stone, big as well, 5'10". And I'm small. I mean, I'm small framed and small built. So, you know, there was part of it which was sort of ludicrous, really, in that I was this mosquito hurling itself, this vast mass. But she was never comfortable, either in her own skin, certainly not with sex or sexuality, but crucially not with physicality. And she didn't know how to hug or to hold, I think because she'd never been hugged and held, you know, and that does such a lot of damage.
You said you didn't think your parents had sex, and I think
no.
Children often will think that about their parents. Whether they're right or wrong is a totally different question. But you think they really had a sexless marriage?
Yeah, I do. I think at the beginning that something went very wrong, and I think after they found Jesus, that just completely stopped. But I did find the 1950 sex manual hidden among the flannels. It was called How to Please Your Husband. And it was a terrifying tome, full of diagrams and lists and tips. And I'm sure it was one of the reasons why they never managed to get anywhere. I mean, you couldn't possibly if you followed this manual. It really would put you off for life.
Let me get, looks like Jane from Westchester to join our conversation. And Jane, go ahead, you're on the air.
Hello.
Hi.
Hello. I loved your book, Oranges Are Not the Only Fruit. And I was actually born in Lancashire and lived in Blackburn, Lancashire, for a long time. So I sort of know the area that you came from. And I wondered how you feel about, do you love Lancashire? Do you hate it? Do you go back there? Is it a place that you have sort of strong feelings about?
Thank you, Jane. Yes, go ahead, Jeanette.
I don't go back there much, not since my father died. I used to go to visit him. I mean, when I go there, I feel an emotional connection. I'm moved by the landscape. You know, you know what the Pennine Chain is like. It's a low mountain range in the north of England, and it's thick-chested and massy and tussocky and brooding. It's not pretty. You know, it's not rolling hills. But it does have a rough beauty to it, which naturally is what I was brought up with, and so I feel close to that. But the 20th century, 21st century, these are the centuries of exile and diaspora. We've all gone some other place. We've all made a home far away from home.
Going back to this first novel that you wrote, Oranges Are Not the Only Fruit, described as semi-autobiographical, is that a fair description of what that novel was?
I suppose so, if we've got to have a label. I mean, it's like calling Why Be Happy a memoir. You know,
yes,
I call
exactly.
it a cover version. Because it's always a cover version, isn't it? I mean, one of the things about memory is that it's not a fixed point on a line in the past. It's a many-faceted place, like a crystal. It's a clustered thing which releases different parts of itself according to the moment when you remember it. And this isn't about lying or false memory or implanted memory. You know, watch this summer. The hot topic of neuroscience is exactly this, you know, because they've never read Proust. They're now deciding that memory is something, it's a narrative, and that we participate in that narrative when we return to the memory, which Freud obviously knew, because otherwise there'd be no point of psychotherapy,
sure.
would there? If you couldn't go back and redeem the past, understand it in a different way, if it was fixed, we'd all be doomed. But it's the fact that nothing really is fixed, which is so exciting, and that's why I try and push away from the labels. And, you know, we're always saying, is it this, is it that? But it's not. You know, and if we could forget the labels and go into the experience, we'd probably have a better time of it.
I appreciate that, and I understand what you said, but also as an interviewer, interviewing someone about their memoir, as it's
still want the tick box.
Well, no, it's even more than that, which is, you know, I'm relying on your memory of your childhood. I know nothing about you.
No.
It's a you know, fantastic story in so many ways. I'm not questioning or doubting you in any way. So I understand the malleability of memory as well, which is even in my own life. There are things that I think happened to me, but, you know, at my advanced age, I'm not sure whether they did or not, or whether I've just thought them so much that it feels real.
Well, I still wouldn't make that distinction. You know, we're still in that mind-matter split, which is it's so old-fashioned. You know, we are the entity that we are. We are the totality of our experience and our imagination and also how we understand that experience. I mean, if you say to me, did your parents have a gospel tent? The answer is yes, these are facts. You know, are you adopted? Yes. All of these facts in the book are so. But if I were to revisit this material again in 25 years, I'm sure I'll write you a different book.
Fair enough, and we'll have you back on the show and see where we are in your life.
You also
write about hearing voices, and that can mean so many different things, especially for someone with a vivid imagination like yours. What did you mean by that?
Well, hearing voices now drops people in the crazy category. You know, murderers and psychopaths hear voices. They used to be a less toxic tradition, something more honourable about visitations, visions, dream images, whether they were audible or not, where you might get some sort of larger message that didn't seem to just come out of your own skin. We all know about that. You know, there have been prophets and prophetesses and seers and sages. We became uncomfortable with that, really, from the sort of mid-19th century. And it's got worse and worse. You know, the American Psychiatric Association would probably bang me up if they could hear this radio interview, because, you know, everything now is a mental illness. Not so. I think that the whole psyche points towards mental health, that we're always trying to heal ourselves. And I think that our minds will manifest whatever is needed for the job of healing. So that sometimes, you know, when you're at your wit's end, you might hear a voice that gives you a good idea or tells you to do something, and maybe you should think about that or listen to it. But what I try and do in the book is show what happens when a mind does disintegrate, because I had a large mental breakdown, and to show then how from those pieces, those coloured fragments, the mind tries to reconstruct itself and put you back together again whole. I didn't take any drugs, I didn't want to do any medication, because I needed to go through that myself and come out with my own head on, not with one that had been invented by the big pharma along the way. And you do get well, but you know, the crucial thing is that going mad takes time and getting sane takes time, and in our society there's no time. Everybody's scared stiff, they just want to put you on the pills and stop you causing trouble, and that way you cut off your own authentic lived experience. And sometimes we need to go crazy, because hell, it's a crazy world out there.
So you needed to go crazy in a way?
Yeah, I did. I needed to. My personality as it was had to go through a complete breakdown in order to be rebuilt. You know, in biblical terms, you know, it is what happens in a religious conversion. And, you know, the strange thing is, because of my background, at my lowest ebb, I suddenly realised that this was a second birth, a second life, a second chance, that I would have to choose life in a very conscious way, rather than having just been given life, as we all are. And that was a huge change for me. Yeah.
Like an exorcism?
No, because that was completely negative. You know, when that happened to me in my youth, it was a horrible experience, and it did nothing, nothing of any value whatsoever. But I think when the personality itself disintegrates, it's usually because there's a good reason, and you can rebuild it and re-find yourself in a much better, stronger, saner place, but only if you're allowed to do so. And the first thing that will interfere with you being allowed to do so is if everybody shoves you on medication and tells you you're crazy. That's the last thing you need. You know, you need to read books, you need poetry, you need music, you need nature, and you need some good friends. You might get through.
And you might get through. As you were describing hearing voices, I was thinking that in many ways we talk to ourselves all the time.
Yeah,
you know, we are always in conversation with ourselves about what's going on around us, what we're dealing with, what our life is about.
We're creatures who love a dialogue, aren't we?
Yes.
So there's nothing wrong with that. It's good.
And again, I don't want to give too much away, but you did meet your birth mother, Anne S., one of the three mothers that you dedicate this book to. After your first meeting, she texted you, "I hope you weren't disappointed," which is interesting.
It's very moving.
It is very moving.
I know.
And what does, I guess that tells us a lot about who she is.
Yeah. I mean, she was very nervous, not least because, you know, I am highly educated. I have made a different life. And she wondered if I would, you know, reject her from in the position that she was. Not at all. But you know, that nervousness was there. And also, she was right in some ways, because you know, these adopted reunions, they're never rosy Hollywood pink mist happy endings. You know, they're difficult. The DNA doesn't do it. You know, this talk about biology. the connection isn't there if you haven't been brought up with, grown up with somebody. You know, it's the nurture is very important, who you're with, how you grow up, what your life experiences are. And ours were very, very different. So I'd say to anybody who just come across their birth family, don't beat yourself up, don't blame yourself, and don't pile on the expectations.
Did you feel the need to forgive her for giving you up?
Yes, and I hope I have. It's unclear to me yet whether actually... I don't think I have forgiven her, you know, yet, which is not in a malevolent way. I just have to tell the truth about those feelings. I know Mrs. Winterson is in the clear now. But, you know, Anne and I did have a huge row at one point. So clearly I was furious about what had happened. And I need to work that through. That needs time. It needs to be sluiced out of my system. And, you know, that's good. That's, again, we're back to what takes time. None of this happens overnight. You know, we're here for a lifetime and we've got to use every bit of it till the last breath.
Was this a hard book to write?
No, it was remarkably clean, and it pushed through at great speed. You know, in 2 weeks I'd written 15,000 words, mm-hmm. Which tells you that there was a lot going on. It was ready to go. You know, I've been working for 25 years. Sometimes you get a kind of gift, an act of grace. Something just pushes through the event horizon. Or it almost writes you rather than you write it, and such was the nature of this book.
And we're almost out of time. Was it hard then to end the book only because it sounded like it was speaking through you?
No, I pulled it back at proof stage and put the coda in. And the last line of the book is, I have no idea what happens next.
Well, it's been a great pleasure, Jeanette Winterson. Thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you.
You're welcome. And the book, her memoir, written after more than 25 years after her first book was written, is called Why Be Happy When You Could Be Normal. And Jeanette Winterson is the author of almost a dozen novels, a book of nonfiction, a comic book, several books for children, and also two screenplays. And that first book that she wrote more than 25 years ago, a novel called Oranges Are Not the Only Fruit. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can find out much more about this program, including Facebook, Twitter, email, and the archives. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, and the show is produced by Susan Greenbaum, Patty Leswing, Dennis Devine, and Debbie Builder. I'm Marty Moscoane. Thank you so much for joining us.